From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week's revelation in the New York Times marked an escalation in the ongoing struggle over government secrecy. It reported that more than 55,000 pages of declassified documents stretching back decades had simply disappeared from public view, reclassified despite the fact that many of the documents had been for years publicly accessible, copied, and widely disseminated. The reclassification of these documents is in some ways the latest pull in a tug of war that began when then-President Clinton signed a 1995 executive order expediting the release of massive amounts of Cold War Pentagon and intelligence agency documents. Matthew Aid is the historian who inadvertently discovered the missing documents and the program that disappeared them. He joins us now. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So how did you discover that these documents were missing?
Purely by accident. While doing research for my book, I submitted a request to see some State Department documents, which I had examined some 9 years ago, and got the response back that the documents had been withdrawn from the public record in late 1999. I basically interrogated a series of National Archive staff members and asked them why the documents had been withdrawn. Most were very reluctant to say anything at all because evidently there was an order not to speak to researchers about the subject. Finally, I found an archivist who was frustrated and very brave and told me the whole story.
Do you have a sense of generally the kind of documents that have been removed?
I do. Most of the documents that had been removed were in the form of memos and reports that generally tended to be very critical of the Pentagon and the CIA's performance, but were very mundane and very dull. The documents they're pulling relate, for example, to the budget for the State Department Intelligence Office for the years 1948-49. They're classifying documents relating to assessments of Guatemalan agrarian reform in 1951.
Along with a bunch of documents that were really right for declassification, there were some that you say should never have been declassified, that they were downright scary. So perhaps this entire program was an overreaction to a very real problem.
There are, for example, in the records of the predecessor to the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, assassination manuals. There are manuals on how to construct high-explosive devices from garden-variety materials. There are also in a variety of records, which, by the way, the CIA and the Pentagon have not even looked in, very technical documents relating to the biological weapons development programs that we were engaged in the late 1940s and 1950s. I understand enough from my university biology class to know that these things probably should not be on the public shelves. These documents were declassified in the 1980s and have remained on the public shelves now for going on 30 years.
And yet you're saying these are precisely the documents that they haven't gone through. Instead, they're going through documents that really don't seem to pose any national security risk at all.
That's absolutely correct.
Now, there is an oversight body for changes in classification. It's called the Information Security Oversight Office. It wasn't notified in this case. And the explanation is that these documents were not actually declassified to begin with, even though they were stamped declassified and reviewed before putting on the shelf. So if they were never declassified, then nobody needs to be told that they're undeclassified.
It is almost Dali-esque. Now, the fact that the government has said that they were inadvertently released is a legalism which allows them to get around the strictures of the executive order signed by President Clinton and amended by President Bush in 2003, which requires any agency engaging in reclassification work to formally and in writing notify the Information Security Oversight Office that they had made that decision. They did not.
You know, Matthew, I'm wondering, the New York Times piece that broke on Monday made reference to 30 reviewers and contractors for the defense and the intelligence agencies poring every weekday over these documents and deciding which to reclassify in a custom-built $1 million room. How did this kind of effort go unnoticed?
I think this is a question that Congress should be asking. As best as I can tell, talking with friends of mine on Capitol Hill, this entire effort has been funded through back channels. It has never been formally approved by any congressional committee that my friends are aware of. There are going to be hearings held by Congressman Chris Shays of Connecticut in 3 weeks' time, and this is probably one of the questions that is going to get asked, if not by the members of the committee, certainly by myself and other interested members of the public.
What can you do as a historian besides testify? Could you gum up the works with a bunch of Freedom of Information requests?
That's one possibility. I could file FOIA requests for each and every one of the 55,000 pages of documents that have been reclassified and drown the agencies in paperwork. I think more practically, what I think should happen is that Bill Leonard's Information Security Oversight Office should continue the audit that it's conducting right now of all the documents that have been reclassified. Hopefully, we'll manage to terminate this program and send the security screeners off to do something more meaningful with their lives.
What do you think the real stakes are here?
A lot of this is multiple government agencies that have been struggling with each other over the whole issue of declassification. By the time these people are finished, they could potentially remove several hundred thousand pages of documents. The kinds of documents they're taking out are those that do not necessarily reflect well on those agencies. And I think as a result, they're warping history.
Matthew Aid, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Matthew Aid is an independent intelligence historian and recently completed the first volume of a multi-volume history of the National Security Agency. On CBS Public Eye, the website where CBS viewers and CBS News staff can talk to each other, Pentagon reporter David Martin this week posted a candid explanation of his reasons for holding a story on improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, in Iraq. Basically, it was because a senior military officer told him to, and since it was very close to deadline, he did. But it's more complicated than that. In fact, Martin says it's usually more complicated than that.
It is. For one thing, the senior military officer didn't outright say, "I want you to hold that story." In fact, he said, "What you do is your decision, but I'm telling you that story has information which we don't want the enemy to have." I had come up with a story which identified a problem that the Pentagon was having in trying to defeat these IEDs, and what the Pentagon was doing in an effort to correct that problem. We were planning on it being the lead story one night last week, and late in the afternoon, this officer's aide came to me and said he'd like to talk to me, and I told him, you know, your argument does not exactly overwhelm me. I mean, he wasn't making a clear-cut case. You put that in a story, and the enemy will do this, and that will kill American soldiers.
But you decided to give him the benefit of the doubt.
I did. There's a war on. And part of my job is to go out on a fairly regular basis to Walter Reed Army Medical Center and do stories about the wounded. Whenever you walk into the physical therapy room at Walter Reed, it is filled with young men missing limbs thanks to IEDs. And you know you just don't want to have anything to do with anything that would contribute to that. And that's why it really was not a hard decision for me or for the broadcast to give the military the benefit of the doubt on this.
So then how do you decide that a story contains sensitive information that shouldn't see the light of day? And when do you decide to go against the advice of military authorities?
Well, I like to say that it's kind of like pornography. You can't come up with a definition that fits all cases, but you know it when you see it. In this case of the IED story, this is not like warrantless eavesdropping or secret CIA prisons. I didn't see any larger issue here that would justify any level of risk.
You say you've gone with the advice of military officials over the years and held a story, and almost every time you write, it's turned out that going with the story wouldn't have caused any harm. Do you have regrets about holding a lot of those stories?
Well, sure. I mean, regrets that you could have had a real good story, but compare that regret to a regret you would have if you reported something that arguably got someone killed. In 1983, the U.S. was making a lot of noise about a Caribbean island called Grenada, where Soviets were allegedly supporting what the Reagan administration called sort of a communist bastion in the Caribbean. And there was a case in which some American medical students on that island were being held hostage. I reported that an aircraft carrier and a marine amphibious group had been sent down there to go in and rescue those students. I had no idea that we were about to invade Grenada. I reported that on Friday, and on Monday we invaded Grenada. And I was subsequently told that the Cubans had sent reinforcements to Grenada to help organize their defenses over the weekend, and that the way the Cubans had found out that the aircraft carrier and the marine amphibious group was going down there was from my story.
So fair enough, once burned, twice shy, or more than twice shy. But do you feel that you've ever been had? Or to make it less personal, do you feel that the audience was sometimes cheated of important news as a result of your following military advice that really didn't, in the end, hold water?
No, I don't feel that I was had, because it's not like these are cases where they're trying to argue that I should cover up a scandal. They're simply arguing that I should hold a story on a military operation. And if I end up erring on the side of caution, so be it.
David Martin is the Pentagon correspondent for CBS News.
Coming up, while Iraq burns, reporters there burn out, and Al Jazeera comes to America.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The news from Iraq this week started out bloody and only got bloodier. Sectarian tensions already running high erupted in the wake of Wednesday's attack on an historic Shiite mosque in Samarra. Over the next 2 days, dozens of Sunni mosques were attacked in reprisals, and more than 130 Iraqis were killed, including several Sunni clerics. and three Iraqi journalists who worked for Al Arabiya TV. It brought the number of journalists and media workers killed in Iraq since the beginning of the war to 87, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Suzanne Fisher is the Iraq Country Director for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, a group that trains local journalists. She says violence is hardly the only threat to the Iraqi media. There's also routine harassment from both Iraqi officials and U.S. soldiers. But she says it's by far the most serious threat, and it's only gotten worse in the past year.
Some reporters don't even tell their mothers that they're working as journalists. And the political climate has also changed for journalists because it's much more difficult nowadays for Iraqi journalists to get interviews with politicians or officials. The politicians very often refuse completely to give interviews to journalists who are opposed to their political direction.
So now that the government is established, there's a lot of bureaucratic red tape that the reporters have to negotiate. But how safe is it to criticize people in power generally?
There's a big difference, I think, between different parts of the government. I think, for example, that the president, Talabani, handles the press rather professionally. He has very good advisors. But it can be very dangerous for journalists to criticize local politicians. Very often they're just arrested for months without being tried, and some reporters report about being beaten up by the police, so it's rather dangerous to be critical.
Tell me about the pressures posed by the U.S. military occupation. I know that last year there were 7 documented cases of Iraqi journalists who were detained for weeks or months at a time by the American military, and one remains in custody now. Is this a big concern for the journalists that you've been training?
This is a very big concern for journalists who usually go to areas where if they want to report about the insurgency, they have to talk to the insurgents. But then they're suspicious in the eyes of the military because they think they have contacts to people that they are looking for.
This week, we watched as sectarian violence in Iraq boiled over and scores of people were killed. What does this increasing sectarianism mean for the free media?
The media is very much divided along these sectarian lines. Most of the media outlets are financially dependent on parties and political associations. At least it would help very much if a newspaper wasn't financially dependent on a political party, but so far there is no economic structure for such an independent news outlet here. There are hardly any commercials. There is no real distribution system. People don't pay much for newspapers.
I wonder, given all of the other problems the Iraqi people have to deal with right now, how high on the list is press freedom?
That's actually a good question. Iraqi people are not so concerned about this. The press in general in Iraq under Saddam, it was always state-controlled, and they didn't expect very much from the media. And I have often run into people who still don't think that journalists ever tell them the truth.
In a media landscape so full of obstacles and barriers, what do you think the biggest accomplishment has been so far?
I find it quite amazing that despite all the obstacles, there has been a lot of progress, especially with young journalists who didn't work as journalists under the former regime. Many, many young journalists still strongly believe in a free press. They try, even if it's a party newspaper, to get in independent news reporting, to report across the sectarian lines. They look for the places where they can publish their things, and the internet is a great hope, too.
Where do they get their models?
I hope they get a little bit from what we teach them, and then, of course, they all watch a lot of satellite television. And many of them have met very many international reporters and have worked for them and saw how they are reporting. And I think many of those foreign journalists who worked in Iraq are their models.
All right. Suzanne, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Suzanne Fisher is the Iraq Country Director for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
Farnaz Fasihi recently left Iraq after 3 years of covering the war for the Wall Street Journal. In the fall of 2004, she sent an email to friends about her frustrations with the conditions that limited her coverage of Iraq. That email wound up being more discussed than any of her articles for the Journal, and it seemed to give other journalists an opening to talk about their own issues. Upon leaving Iraq, she signed off with a long and personal piece that ran in the weekend edition of her paper. She joins me now on the phone from her new assignment in Beirut to talk about that piece and about covering what she called the story of her generation. Farnaz, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, forgive me for not quoting from the Saturday piece and going to the old email from 2 years ago, but It's so compact. And I just want to read a few sentences here. It says, I avoid going to people's homes and never walk in the streets. I can't go grocery shopping anymore, can't eat in restaurants, can't strike a conversation with strangers, can't look for stories, can't drive in anything but a fully armored car, can't go to scenes of breaking news stories, can't be stuck in traffic, can't speak English outside, can't take a road trip, can't say I'm an American, can't linger at checkpoints, can't be curious about what people are saying, doing, feeling, and can't, and can't. Now, this sounds like the ultimate expression of a reporter's frustration. I gather the situation didn't improve in the intervening 2 years.
I think that it's gone up and down, but generally I would say that things have not changed much from what you just quoted. I wrote that email right when things were changing. It was incredibly frustrating because we had just gone from being able to fully operate within a couple of months to being almost imprisoned.
The piece that I read in the journal this week begins with just the most chilling detail. You're talking about how you're preparing to say all your goodbyes in Iraq and that you've got a party scheduled and you're going to go individually and meet colleagues. Mm-hmm. But in the end, your security advisors say, no, don't do it. There are rumors that insurgents want to kidnap a female American journalist. Mm-hmm. And you canceled your plans.
Right.
So you left Iraq, and then arriving back in the United States, you read of the abduction of Jill Carroll. Tell me about that.
The initial report didn't say it was Jill, and I immediately called colleagues in Baghdad to find out who it was. And when I found out, it was just devastating. And I knew what my colleagues were doing. You just drop whatever you're doing, and you get on the phone, and you try to do anything in your ability to help your colleague. You know, I called our office manager in Baghdad, and I instructed him to call all of our best sources in the Iraqi government on my behalf and ask them as a personal favor to do anything they can to help Jill.
Now, Jill Carroll is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We're having this conversation on Wednesday with her fate hanging at the whims of her captors. I want to ask you again about the obstacles. Mm-hmm. For now 2 years, it's been very clear that reporters simply can't go out on the field and report the way they're accustomed to doing it.
Right.
Often you're reduced to using third parties, Iraqi journalists, going to do your legwork, and then you work from essentially secondhand reporting.
Right.
As you look back, is it worth it?
Bob, we're the only independent observers of this war. If it weren't for us, the world would rely on the governments to give them information of how things are going, or the military. I think it's certainly not the most gratifying way of doing our jobs, but I still think it's hugely important that we maintain as independent observers and try to tell the story of what's happening there in our best ability.
You spent, all told, approximately 3 years in Iraq, from before Saddam was toppled to the present.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a possibility that 3 years working under those conditions somehow colors your journalistic perceptions in a way that you lose your journalistic distance?
I was fortunate to be there around the first year where I could travel freely and really get to know the country. So I think that really worked to my advantage. I think it was a unique war for journalists because the barrier that separates you as an independent journalist and the war and the danger dissolved in Iraq. We were just as much a target. Where we lived came under target. We were kidnapped. We had no immunity. Sometimes it felt like nobody saw value to having reporters there. So I think that part of it was difficult to try to work around that challenge.
When you read criticism of the press in general, that it is somehow so fixated on bad news that it doesn't report the good, that it's essentially suppressing the good news out of Iraq, what do you all say to one another? How do you react?
I can just say that if there were 5 car bombs going off in New York and 50 people kidnapped a day, I'm sure that Metro reporters would be writing those stories and not talking about the school that was painted. When you're sitting in Iraq and putting your neck on the line to try to bring as balanced a story as possible, it's very frustrating to hear criticism like that because you know as a professional reporter that the only reason you're there is because you want to convey the truth. And I can say that everyone is trying to go out their extra mile to find out exactly what's happening there, good or bad, to try to find progress, obstacles, frustrations. And I think considering, we've done a pretty good job. I'm proud of what my colleagues have achieved.
Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Farnaz Fasihi is senior Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. In May, Al Jazeera, now solely an Arabic language news channel, will launch Al Jazeera International, an English language version of the network and the first English language news channel based in the Middle East. Al Jazeera claims that it will be the first truly unbiased international news network, while critics, who have long seen Al Jazeera as an anti-American propaganda tool, wait to see how Al Jazeera International will distinguish itself from its parent. Al Jazeera has hired a slew of reporters and anchors from all over the world, including former U.S. Marine Joshua Rushing, featured in the documentary Control Room, and veteran British reporter Sir David Frost. They've also hired Dave Marish, former correspondent for ABC News' Nightline. Marish will anchor from Al Jazeera International's D.C. studio.
Al Jazeera in Arabic is, I believe, one of the most revolutionary and positive influences on the Arabic-speaking, mostly Islamic, Middle Eastern world in literally centuries. It has opened up public discourse, and it has brought American standards of reporting to an area that previously had nothing but really moronically state-controlled television and news operations.
Al Jazeera in Arabic serves some 40 million Arabic-speaking viewers around the world, but mostly in the Middle East. According to Marish, Al Jazeera aims to create the widest possible debate, and that means including the most extreme views.
And to us in the West, the extremes of that context seem obnoxious or worse, even intolerable. But in that region, if Al Jazeera in Arabic were politically correct and scrubbed the extremes from its debate, it would lose all of its credibility with its viewers, who know that anti-Israeli attitudes are prevalent in the region, and flat, ugly anti-Semitic attitudes are also widely distributed. The only way that I believe that they can be combated is in direct intellectual combat, and you can't do that by excluding them. Now, Al Jazeera International is going to be a global channel operating from four regional bases, 11 hours a day from Doha in Qatar, 5 hours a day from London, 5 hours a day from Washington, 3 hours a day from Kuala Lumpur. Over the course of a 24-hour day, you're going to hear globally significant news stories discussed and approached from four different regional points of view.
Clearly, the brand name Al Jazeera carries with it a whole lot of baggage. Do you think that could complicate the fairly mundane task of booking guests for Al Jazeera International in Washington or elsewhere in the world?
I don't think the guest booking is going to be a problem because most of the people whom we would want to book as guests know the Al Jazeera brand does stand for editorial integrity and quality. Obviously, I think when it comes to distribution, particularly on cable systems in the United States, many of the false things that people think they know about Al Jazeera will create a political problem. You know, a lot of canards have been spread about Al Jazeera by very high-ranking government officials who repeat them in the face of repeated corrections as to their falsity. For example, Donald Rumsfeld has said Al Jazeera shows beheadings. Never, 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 never. And in fact, when we do show videos, for example, of hostages, Al Jazeera in Arabic regularly scrubs the sound off them because they do not want to spread pleas for people's lives that are being forced on them under duress. Why do they show the video? Well, one, we think that it does keep hostages alive by increasing their value. And two, because the hostage situation, and in the case of Jill Carroll in particular in the United States, these are news stories. And that's how they're covered, as news.
Al Jazeera is principally owned by the Emirate of Qatar. And your salary, I presume, ultimately comes from government coffers. How does that affect the way you're going to approach your work? And do you fear some sort of political restraints on what Al Jazeera International may be able to do?
In a way, that's one of Al Jazeera's advantages, I believe, Bob. The state of Qatar has about 150,000 people in it. It has some oil, but not huge oil wealth. And the state and the emir have basically made a capitalist decision that there are two sectors in which they are going to take their present oil revenue and try and make that a base for future revenue. One of those sectors is the media, the various Al Jazeera channels. The other is education, where the wife of the emir has been instrumental in setting up a large university in Qatar, expected to become, as Al Jazeera is expected to become, a revenue-producing a capitalist base, if you will, for this state. Qatar really has one national interest other than its economic growth, and that would be survival. Beyond that, it can hardly pretend to have real national interests, and so therefore, Al Jazeera is almost perfectly clear of any national interest or any dictated political policy.
I want to ask you one final thing. You're Jewish, and you've already taken some criticism of being a self-loathing Jew, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel. You've been called Marish of Arabia. What's it like going through this experience and dealing with that portion of the American Jewish community that thinks you're a traitor?
You have to just shake off what are basically hysterical, ignorant, and ugly statements. I am proud to be a Jew. I believe if harmony is to be achieved between the Judeo-Christian West and the mostly Islamic Middle East, the first people who will be making steps towards peace on the Arab side are the modernizers, are the secularists, are the free market, free speakers. In other words, the very people who started and back and, I believe, listen to value Al Jazeera in Arabic and hopefully Al Jazeera International. I'm proud to associate myself with those on the Jewish side who do seek peace and harmony. And if that offends some of my co-religionists or fellow Americans, all I can say is it's a free country.
All right, Dave. Well, good luck in the new gig.
Thank you, Bob.
Dave Marish will be the senior Washington anchor of Al Jazeera International when it launches this spring.
Coming up, victims of email scams fight back, and why flash mobs won't be coming to a neighborhood near you.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's not every day you're asked to safeguard and share the fortunes of a millionaire who died without heirs. Oh, wait. Yes, it is, if you have an email account, in which case you almost certainly have constant encounters with the notorious Nigerian 419 fraud. It's estimated that the scam, which asks for a gullible recipient's bank account number in exchange for promised millions, is the third largest industry in Nigeria. And its perpetrators exist in a kind of legal netherworld, not worth the price of international policing and protected by Nigeria's culture of corruption. Targets of the 419 scam, named for Section 419 in the Nigerian Criminal Code, have formed vigilante groups with names like Artists Against 419 and are taking the law into their own hands, mobilizing victims around the world to strike back. Josh Rosenblum wrote about these online avengers for Legal Affairs magazine, and he explained how the scam works.
The basic premise of the scam is that there's some hidden cache of money. Now, it might be lottery winnings. It might be an estate where the owner of that estate has died without any heirs. And it can be yours if only you're willing to front some money to help with things like bribing officials or paying taxes or somehow greasing the wheels that's going to get the money in your hands.
Tell me, how many people are suckered into this kind of deal and how much money they're losing?
It's very difficult to get an exact number because many people are ashamed of coming forward once they've been taken in by a scam. The Internet Crime Complaint Center has registered every year since 2000 a 50% increase in the complaints reported to it. That's over 200,000 complaints in 2004 alone. Obviously, not all of those are of the Nigerian scam variety, but a portion of them are, and it keeps growing. This scam is estimated by the Secret Service and by other governments to pull in hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
How in the world could anybody fall for so transparent, a gambit?
That's a great question. And there are different explanations depending on who you ask. I think the most common explanation is greed. People want to believe that they're getting something for nothing.
Okay, now I know that if I sent some sort of illegal communication, a death threat or some such thing, that I could be traced through my internet service provider to, I guess, my very own IP address and eventually, track down like they do with hackers and other criminals. Why can't the cops get close to the Nigerian scammers?
Well, there are several reasons for that. One just has to do with the fact that this is an international crime. And the host country for many of these scammers, Nigeria, the law enforcement does not function as effectively as it does in the States or in Western Europe. So even if they were able to identify the perpetrator, it's unlikely that law enforcement would actually go after them. The second reason may be that a lot of times these perpetrators will take over another computer and use that computer to send out the emails. And so the person who's actually sending the email may be an innocent who's sending that email unawares.
So frustrated by the inability of law enforcement and the Nigerian government to crack down, various victims and near victims have taken the law into their own hands. How have they done that?
Some of them are, your prototypical geek IT folks. Some of them are retired professors, retired doctors, retired lawyers who have time on their hands. And what these organizations have done is that they've made it extremely simple for anybody without a great deal of technical knowledge to take down these websites. The basic idea here is to waste the scammer's time. So you reply to the email and you make it appear as though, you're interested. This offer sounds good to you. And sure, you'd be willing to invest, but you need a few more details. In one sort of very humorous case, a scam baiter said, "We would love to invest, but we belong to a particular religious order called the Holy Order of the Red Breast. We will only invest if you join our order and send along photos to prove it," in which case the scammer actually did send along pictures of him stripped to the waist with this red symbol painted on his chest. The real goal here is just by wasting scammers' time, you make it less likely that they'll identify an actual victim and make it less profitable for them as well.
Apart from catching these guys red-chested, another option is to just shut down the tools of their trade.
That's correct. These scammers have become more sophisticated. And if you go back to them and say, "Listen, this sounds good, but I'm really not convinced. Is the money really there?" What they may do is send you a link to this fake lottery website or a fake bank website. where they can show you, yes, indeed, the $20 million that this wealthy person left without an heir is in fact sitting in that bank. And so one of the things that some of these groups have begun to do is to attack these fake bank websites or these fake lottery websites, because these are used more and more as tools to support the con.
Well, let me ask you this. The next time I get an email that begins, "I humbly beg your attention for a moment as I discuss the problem I have finding an owner for this $20 million inheritance," what should I do?
Well, you definitely should not reply to it. These people are serious, and there have been murders associated with this scam, both murders by the scammers and revenge killings by people who've been taken advantage of. I think there are several things that you should do. There are several governmental organizations within the United States, the Secret Service and the Internet Crime Complaint Center, which is co-run by the FBI, all take reports of attempts to scam or successful scams. As we've talked about, there are less official organizations that if you forward that email to them, they will either scam bait that individual, or if that scammer is operating a website as part of the scam, they may try to take down that website either through legal means or through some of the more aggressive tactics we've talked about.
Well, Josh, thank you very much.
Absolutely. I appreciate the time.
Josh Rosenblum is assistant editor at the now online Legal Affairs magazine.
In the summer of 2003, the world witnessed a new type of email-generated constituency when a couple of hundred people materialized one June evening in the rug department of a Manhattan Macy's. They told the sales attendant that they all lived together, were in the market for a love rug, and were especially interested in the large Persian over in the corner. After exactly 10 minutes, they left. In reality, they did not live together or even know each other. Rather, they had all received forwarded emails with simple instructions about when, where, and how to congregate. A reporter covered the event, and a blogger gave it a name, Flash Mob. Six more flash mobs took place in New York that summer, and countless more in other cities and countries. 2 weeks earlier, the very first flash mob was stymied by police, apparently tipped off. Also tipped off was Dean Olsher of the late public radio show The Next Big Thing, who was in the mob.
So have you watched what's happening?
Yeah, apparently a mob is forming. A very calm, collected, literary mob.
Bill's the one who organized the mob.
Oh, you know the organizer of the mob?
Oh my gosh.
Do you know Bill's last name?
Well, I don't want to say his last name in case he wants to remain anonymous.
Just point him out.
I respect that. I will point.
In fact, he did want to remain anonymous, identifying himself to reporters simply as Bill, a New Yorker who works in the culture industry. But in the March issue of Harper's Magazine, Bill outs himself. Turns out he's Bill Wasik, a senior editor of that magazine. He explains that flash mobs were both a performance piece about a New York culture of conformity and an absurdist riff on viral marketing.
Normally with viral marketing, there's something at the center of it, whether it's a product or a funny website, something at the middle of it. And I thought, well, what if you did a viral marketing campaign where essentially there was nothing at the middle of it? The only thing that would be there would be the people who came to see it. And by being there, they themselves would become the event. So the idea would be to, you know, take the buzz around an art project and remove the art project and all you have left is the buzz. That was the idea. My original notion was that the project would spread entirely through email. And I was pleasantly surprised to see that it got picked up in the media. And that helped to fuel the spread of the fad to other cities. It spread to other countries. And then inevitably, there was a backlash. And in my piece, I sort of date the backlash to this New York Times article that came out in October of 2003.
And you explain that probably the motivation for the backlash piece is that the Times was too late to cover the beginning of the fad and so called an end to it, perhaps prematurely, in order to have a headline.
You know, I stand by that allegation. No, I mean, I think a lot of this stuff goes on the parts of journalists subconsciously, because the idea is, you know, if you're going to advance the story, then you need to have an angle. I mean, it's journalism 101. And for people in other cities, the angle was, hey, this crazy fad's coming to our town. In the Times, I think their angle was, this fad has spread so much that now there's a backlash growing against it. Of course, the great irony about that Times backlash story is around the time that that story appeared was when the phenomenon really was at its height. I mean, we really had spread to not just, you know, U.S. cities, but I was getting reports of them in Latin America and in Asia and that kind of a thing. And here comes this backlash story, which I just thought was ironic beyond belief. But a couple of months later, it would have been a fine piece. So, you know, don't get me wrong.
So in that Times story, a civics expert at Harvard's Kennedy School is quoted as saying this: "From our point of view, it's a wasted opportunity, that is, the flash mobs. It's great to have fun, but it would be a lot more interesting if the people organizing this tried to think of ways to utilize it to have people come together to build social networks." That's a real buzzkill, but what do you think? Was that a common response?
Oh, yeah, it was an extremely common response. A lot of people saw the flash mob as somehow being a parody of the protest movement or something that was sapping energy away from the protest movement, which was not my intention at all. But I do think that the idea behind flash mobs was something that just couldn't really be turned towards any kind of political ends, because they were really about a certain kind of insiderness. People were using the outside world as a kind of terrain for private games. The mobs were very much about the mob participants. It wasn't really about showing off to a larger group of people.
So tell me about when you knew it was definitively dead. Tell me about the Fusion Flash concerts.
Well, this summer, I got an email from a friend, and she said, in the subject heading, she said, "Weren't you always worried about this?" And I opened it up, and it was a column describing this marketing promotion, Fusion Flash Concerts, where in order to promote this new car, the Ford Fusion, Ford had partnered with Sony to create this series of flash mob concerts in cities all across the country. And it was something that I had expected. And I actually thought that it would happen sooner because, you know, corporations co-opt anything that they think young people like. They said in the press release, this is a fresh, interactive take on the underground flash mobbing phenomenon. This I thought was especially funny because the flash mob phenomenon had basically died as an underground phenomenon, you know, about 2.5 months after it started.
So in the end, you provided corporate America with another tool for winning hearts and minds, and you assumed that that's where it would ultimately end. But was that pretty much it? Was it really, as you describe in your article, just an empty meditation on emptiness? Or were you after something bigger?
Well, it was a comment on the culture, but to a certain extent, it was a comment on the emptiness of the culture. So in that regard, yeah, that's basically what I was after. But I was, by the end, a little bit touched by people who had brought political ideas to it. And I did begin to feel like there was something there, that there was the germ of some political consciousness inherent in it, even though I myself didn't really see it and didn't really see that it had any future.
Can you give me a reason why you chose to do this experiment now, at this particular moment?
Well, I feel like that the internet has allowed people to converge more quickly on the same ideas about what the cool or most interesting, you know, cultural product is, and that there's a kind of feedback loop that exists among the sort of self-consciously cultured people, at least of a certain age. And I say a certain age simply because, you know, it's the group of people that I know. I mean, it's
and what age is that?
I'm 31. Mm-hmm. That there's a dynamic where they'll quickly converge on a thing and then they'll abandon it. I sort of wish that I had kept doing them until they were so uncool that no one would come anymore. Because really, that would have been the natural endpoint of it, for the thing to become cool and then to become so uncool that there just wasn't a soul there except for pathetic little me. But I think my pride got in the way of me taking it to that endpoint, the long, sad tail end of the abandonment of a fad.
Bill Wasik is a senior editor at Harper's Magazine. His article, which appears in the March issue, is called My Crowd. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And finally, in an era when everyone and everything breaks news, here's a bombshell I found in the featurette that comes with the new DVD release of one of my favorite movies, All the President's Men. You know the film.
I'm Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. Markham.
Markham?
Mr. Markham, are you here in connection with the Watergate burglary?
I'm not here.
All the President's Men, starring Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman as Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, is, of course, far more than a cinematic rendering of Watergate. It is, in fact, the prevailing symbol of all that is fine in American journalism, invoked by media scolds when reporters grow complacent or craven. All the President's Men, the movie, is based on the book of the same name, written by Woodward and Bernstein. Now, here's the bombshell. The team intended to write a different kind of chronicle, one that anatomized the Watergate affair dispassionately and impersonally. But then, a call came from an entirely unexpected quarter. Here's Carl Bernstein.
Woodward came up to me one day and said he'd gotten a call from Redford. And I said, what the hell about? And he said, well, he thinks the story is really us. And at the time, we were still reporting the story, and we sure didn't think the story was really us.
It was helpful to me to hear him say that.
Bob Woodward.
And in the end, we wound up writing All the President's Men as a reporting story. He laid the seed for that in that first phone call.
Robert Redford.
I love the idea of the fact that these guys were doing this hard work from the lowest rung of the professional ladder in their business, and that their work would lead to the takedown of the highest office of the land.
So there you have it. Now, for many, perhaps most Americans, the story of Watergate is just as much about the potential power of gumshoe reporters as it is about the corruption of a president. And it has shaped our perceptions, our expectations of journalism more than our view of the presidency. It's the icon of the Fourth Estate. It's the flag that it wraps around itself when the arrows fly. And the Betsy Ross who stitched that flag, for future generations of news reporters and news consumers, wasn't the duo known as Woodstein. It was Robert Redford.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer, with help from Rob Christensen. We had other assistants from Mark Phillips and Ani Katz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.